Welcome once again to our program, Reasons to Believe, Catholic Apologetics or Fundamental Theology. They all are synonyms for the same thing. Giving an explanation, a reasonable explanation of why we believe in God, why we believe in Jesus as God and man, and we're going to talk today about why we believe in the church. Our guest, as usual, is Ron Eldred, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High for church history, world history, and teaches religion, of course, too. Ron, a particular welcome to you. And the one thing I didn't want to say as we got started, we're always talking about why it's reasonable to believe, to get up to the door where we have to walk through by faith. But I would like to say as we start, the best argument, in my opinion, for the Catholic faith is not all these wonderful things we're saying, but the best argument is a good Catholic. And the worst argument, and the best argument against the Catholic faith is a bad Catholic. It was Ralph Waldo Emerson who said, what you are speaks so loudly that I cannot hear what you're saying. So we realize that the ultimate evangelical outreach is holiness or the goodness of a Catholic trying to live their faith. But on the other hand, to help us be a better Catholic trying to live our faith, we're trying to give structures and foundations on which we can stand and help other people. So we're trying to do what Peter says in his letter, always be prepared to give a reason for the faith that is in you, and do it with gentleness and reverence. I think it's Peter 3, 15 and 16. So Ron, maybe you could summarize a little where we come from, and then we'll get off to a flying start.
Well, at the last, the end of the last half-hour session, we just started taking a look at reasons to believe that Jesus Christ founded the Catholic Church. And this is absolutely essential for the apologists to do, because to prove that, or at least make it reasonable to believe that Jesus Christ has instituted the church and that that church is the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And it's not Holy Scripture or tradition that verifies the truth contained in the Gospels. It is the living church who witnessed these events and who wrote down accounts of them in sacred Scripture and elsewhere. Only the Catholic Church can verify their veracities. Without the witness of the church, the Bible or tradition by themselves could be nothing more than well-meaning stories or myths, legends or folklore. We Catholics believe that all things that we believe because of the reliability of the church that teaches them. One prominent apologist has said that any thoughtful apologist will grasp at once the essential link between Christ and the church and the three major defenses of the church which can be easily made. I think it was St. Augustine that said something to the effect that if it weren't for the Catholic Church, I couldn't believe. I wouldn't believe what's in the scriptures if it wasn't for the church that was there and was the witness and wrote it down and what have you.
And what it means.
Yes. So that's why it's so important to make it reasonable to believe, maybe not prove in the mathematical sense, but at least make it reasonable to believe that Christ did found a church and that the church is the Catholic Church. And then once you have that, then you can accept what the church teaches without any problem, anything that the church teaches without any problem.
Sure. If Jesus, who is God, made man, set up the Catholic Church to continue his teachings down through space and time until he comes again on the clouds of heaven, well, Jesus' fingerprints were on the church, and he says that I will be with you all days to the apostles, even to the end of the world, well, then certainly I want to pay attention to what the church says, because Jesus said, he who hears you hears me. So what we're trying to talk about is the Catholic Church really has the fingerprints of Jesus upon it. Okay?
Yes. Then what we did after that, we set out to prove that from Scripture and history that Christ founded the church, and we quoted several different places from the Bible as a proof text for that. And then we started out with the question, or finished with the question, is it reasonable to believe that the church that Jesus Christ founded is a Catholic church? And so that brings us up to where we ended our last session.
All right, where we are right now.
Yes, where we are right now.
Well, okay, the usual approach of apologetics, and a good approach, I think, is to say that if we read the scriptures, we will find out there are particular marks or identifying marks that would say, here's the church Jesus set up.
Yeah, sometimes they'll call them signs, pointing to, you know, okay, the church.
Or clues, maybe.
Or clues, yes.
Okay. So the usual, without going into all the scriptural background for this, the usual marks or clues or signs that this is the church Jesus set up are one, holy, Catholic, and apostolic. So let's talk about, what do we mean when we say Jesus' church must be one?
The church founded by Jesus Christ must contain only one faith, the same sacrifice, which of course was Calvary first, and then of course each time the Mass represents that,
which we call the sacrifice, yeah, of the Mass.
The holy sacrifice of the Mass.
Okay.
At least that's what it used to be called all the time.
Okay.
It's sort of fallen into abeyance, I think, very tragically. The same sacraments, the same seven sacraments, the same visible head, that is, the successor of St. Peter, the Pope, which simply means father in Latin, or in Italian, I think, Papa.
Papa. Viva il Papa, long live the Pope.
Yes. A leading apologist, I believe it was Peter Kreeft, but I'm not sure, I recall, said that the church possesses a remarkable unity and authority, structure, doctrine, and essential practice across time, place, culture, state and life, and social station. So when we're talking about the oneness, we're talking about the sacraments, one sacrament, one leader, one faith, that type of thing.
Okay, and one of the great evidences we had since, I believe, 1994 was when the church, for the first time since the Vatican Council I, but Council of Trent, issued a new catechism that would say, here's what as Catholics we hold to as essentials of our faith, or whatever country or continent we might belong to, here are the fundamentals of the Catholic faith. And it became a bestseller. I think they sold 8 million copies very early. And Pope John Paul II said this is perhaps his greatest gift to the church, to enable all these ancient teachings of the church down through space and time to be put in a language intelligible to modern man and woman. So certainly the Catholic Catechism is one of the most evident ways we know the church is one in its belief and teaching. All right, how about, what do we mean when they say the church is holy? Because an awful lot of us, and through history, there have been an awful lot of sinners in the Catholic Church, even in high places, and the popes and bishops and priests, and as well as the laity.
The church founded by Jesus Christ, it has to be holy because the founder and the spirit that gives it life are holy. In other words, the Holy Spirit. Because her doctrines, that is her teachings, her sacrifice, that is the holy sacrifice of the Mass, and her sacraments, that is the other six sacraments. The Mass, of course, is the seventh sacrament. They're holy because their members are called to holiness. Not necessarily as you suggested at the beginning of this little discussion here, that they're all holy and have been holy, but we're called to holiness anyway.
Okay.
And to become, and because many of her members have achieved holiness.
Great saints.
Yes.
All through history.
And not just the great saints, but the
Ordinary people.
Our grandmother, my mother, just died about a month ago. My mother was about the holiest woman I've ever known, and just a good, holy woman, a pious woman. And we've all had aunts and uncles and cousins and neighbors down the street and whoever else that are probably in heaven just as well as a canonized saint is.
So it's a great multitude that no man can number that Revelation talks about.
Well, there have been millions and millions of people who are in heaven or in, at least in purgatory on the way to heaven.
Okay.
Being purified. But the apologist that I quoted a while ago says that the church possesses sanctifying effects of her doctrine and sacraments, as well as her fruitfulness and good works and holy persons of every kind.
Okay, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that when we get to the visible and invisible sides of the church.
Yeah.
Okay, what do we mean that the church is Catholic? That word, first of all, what does the word mean?
Well, it's from a Latin word, I believe, means universal.
And I think also in Greek.
In Greek, yes. A number of Protestant churches still say the Nicene Creed. And my wife, before she converted to the Catholic faith, belonged to a German evangelical church down in southern Indiana, where there's quite a few Protestant Germans in some areas, mostly Catholic, though, in a lot of those areas down there, German. But in her church, even though it was a Protestant church, they still said the Nicene Creed. The Nicene Creed every Sunday.
Okay.
And they would say one holy, I believe, Catholic. A lot of times the Protestant churches will change it to universal rather than Catholic, but her particular church still used the word Catholic, meaning, of course.
Sure, it's what it means.
Universal, yes.
And the good Protestants who still use it would explain it by saying, well, we mean universal. We don't mean Catholic in capital letters like the Catholic Catholic Church of the United States.
Well, the Protestant idea, I think, generally is that Jesus established a religion more than an institutional church.
Okay.
And that any group, so to speak, when there's two or more, you know,
gathered together in my name,
I'm sure to be amongst you. And so I think that's sort of the driving force behind a lot of the Catholic, the Protestant denominations. And so anyone who does this really is equally a church. So we're all kind of on an equal plane. And of course, this goes against the grain of what the Catholic Church teaches, you know, that Christ did, in fact, and this is what we're trying to prove, or at least make it reasonable to believe that Christ, in fact, did establish the church. And we did quote from five or six places in the Bible that indicated he did. And then secondly, we're going on now and trying to prove, or at least make it reasonable to believe, that it's the Catholic Church.
That still exists 2,000 years later.
That Christ
but then it goes back in an unbroken chain through the Holy Fathers to Jesus himself and St. Peter. Okay, as I understand, as I know, because you've said it several times, you kind of read your way into the Catholic Church. And some of these things we're talking about, that the Church was one in its teaching and doctrine, that it had produced many, many holy people, and that it was so universal, open to all people of all times, all backgrounds. That was and the next thing we're going to talk about, apostolic, those were some of the things that magnetically pulled you yourself into the church.
Yeah, the church founded by Jesus Christ, it has to be Catholic or universal because she, and we refer to the church as she for reasons that we won't have time to explain here. I think we did kind of do that a little bit in our series on the Nicene Creed, why the church is she. But she was instituted for all men, is suitable for all men and women, of course, and is spread throughout the entire world. So it has a universality in at least those three senses. Again, the apologist that I quoted a couple of other times, that the church is Catholic because her chronological and geographical and social and doctrinal universality has one adherence to the entire faith in every time, place, and group. So all of that put together is what we mean when we say the church is universal, the church is Catholic.
Okay. Teaching the same thing, reaching out to all people from the command of Jesus, teach all nations.
And in all time.
And has actually been in existence. Whether people, nobody can question the fact that the church historically has existed for 2,000 years. They may not agree that it should have.
Or it's the true church.
Right.
But nonetheless, they would admit that it actually did go back
right.
to at least the first century.
Sure, and that people, and one of the reasons people who study history closely are so much drawn to the Catholic Church, because of its going back to the beginning.
Well, as we'll point out later on when we get in, because we're going to look at the Apostolic Fathers a little bit here, and not this session probably, but the next session. When you read these Apostolic Fathers, you're really reading about the church that we know, the Catholic Church. Any Catholic who reads these
And these Apostolic Fathers
say,
are people
right at home with what they're
who were right in the times
yes.
of the apostles.
Yes, right after.
Disciples or followers.
St. Polycarp, St. Irenaeus, St. Justin Martyr.
And you've got some great quotes from them coming up
yes.
a little bit later. All right, let's talk about the church is apostolic. We've already mentioned that, but let's kind of clarify it again. What does it mean, the church is apostolic?
Well, the church founded by Jesus Christ, it has to be apostolic, because she was founded upon the apostles and their preaching, and because she is governed by their successors,
okay.
the bishops and the popes. This apologist that I've been quoting says that the church possesses the ability to trace her teachings and her ministry back to the apostles, including the vital apostolic succession of papal, episcopal, and priestly supernatural powers.
All right, when we're talking about supernatural powers, we're talking about power to consecrate at the Eucharist that Jesus gave to the apostles, an awesome power.
To forgive sins.
Okay, so we're talking about something that every Catholic is familiar with, the Eucharistic mystery and the mystery of forgiveness of sins.
Well, to conclude this, these four signs or these four...
Marks, identity.
Yeah, marks that I was trying to think of, the point of the Catholic Church. Of all the religions in the world, all the churches in the world, only the Catholic Church contains all of these marks, all of these signs. And it can be easily seen that all other religious bodies find themselves partly or totally lacking in one or more of the marks. In fact, most of the other churches are even named by a particular man or a place or a doctrine, whereas the true church has retained the providential name of Catholic from the very beginning.
Okay, I always remember that the first native-born American canonized saint was Elizabeth Ann Seton. And she really struggled. She had been raised a very pious Episcopalian and knew the scriptures well and was an exceedingly holy person. But she struggled to come into the Catholic Church. But one of the things she said that finally convinced me to go back historically, join the church, historically went back to Jesus, was that it was apostolic, and that it actually did historically go back to the time of the apostles. And that was a magnet for her. She said there were others. I always remember them by ABC. A was the church goes back to historically to the time of the apostles. B, it's great. She was greatly drawn by her church's constant devotion to the mother of Jesus, because Jesus was devoted to his mother, and Christians were encouraged to do the same thing. And communion, the real presence of Christ in the Holy Eucharist. She said those three things were kind of the final magnets that brought her back home.
Yeah, she was raised in New York City, as you know, right after the Revolutionary War. And she used to go down to the church, the Catholic Church. There weren't many Catholic churches, of course, in New York at that time, and because of mostly a Protestant America. But she always liked to go to the church that had the cross on the top instead of the weather vane.
Oh, really? I think I'd heard that, but I'd completely forgotten that. I'm trying to remember, was it St. Peter's Church on Barclay Street or something
maybe
like
it
that?
Was, yeah.
And it was a little immigrant Irish church, but that's where she eventually came in and made her profession of faith and her first Holy Communion, which she describes so eloquently.
And she did this a great sacrifice to herself,
oh,
of course,
my.
Because she was disowned by her family. Of course, her husband was
William Seton.
Her husband's already dead. He was a doctor, and he had picked up...
Well, that was her dad who was a doctor, but her husband was a big sea merchant.
Well, that's right. Yeah, he was... He was a kind of a banker, I think, that invested in ships and things like that.
Owner of ships.
Yes, and he got tuberculosis.
Yeah, and he went to Italy.
He went to Italy, and that's where she started coming into contact. They were staying there with some lord.
Felicis,
mm-hmm. Brothers.
Antonio Felici.
And he started telling her about the faith, and then she got more and more...
He saw Antonio Felici was a very deeply devoted Catholic, and his wife and family, mm-hmm. But he saw the gem of the holiness in Elizabeth Ann Seton, and that's why he tried to explain to her the things that he wanted her to know about the church.
Well, after she joined the church, her family and his family, basically his family, was a very wealthy, well-known family, of course, and just disowned her, and her friends all disowned her. They were almost Anglicans or Episcopalians here in the United States, and they.
I think there was maybe one of her friends who stayed with her, kind of wrote to her, but she literally...
Sister-in-law it was, I believe.
Was it?
She had a sister-in-law, and I think she actually became a Catholic herself, and then
and
later
maybe
on joined the religious order.
Yeah. Well, as you were indicating, she literally went from riches to rags.
Literally, yes.
Had to sell all the antiques and fine artwork in her wonderful, beautiful house in New York.
Well, she had five children, too.
Right. And they were stair steps when Bill or William Seton died of tuberculosis in Italy.
But that's why she took up teaching, because to make a living. And she moved to, later on, she moved to Baltimore, if I recall right. And taught school.
What is that? Not Baltimore, but what is that? That's where the place is. It's near Baltimore.
Still there, I think. The first little school that she established is still there. Some of my relatives visited that little school.
My dad and mom visited that. A lot of people visit that place. Okay, well, we got on Elizabeth Ann Seton because it was the apostolic clue that the church historically did go back to Jesus. That was one of the great factors in her becoming Catholic, and then, of course, later on, becoming the founder of the Catholic school system in the United States. Okay, well, are there any other ways besides these traditional clues or marks of the church, one, holy, Catholic, apostolic, that we could point to that would kind of add reasons to believe that Jesus did set up the Catholic Church historically?
Well, we've already looked at the idea of motives of credibility. We spent several sessions telling about that.
And meaning so, reasons to believe.
Reasons to believe. And this is what these are. These are all essentially motives of credibility, which can lead us to, to the door of faith, but it's not going to take us through.
Okay.
Our will has to give assent to it, and then, of course, then God will infuse the theological virtue of divine faith into our soul.
So we need the grace of God to come through the door of faith. Okay. Well, what are some other things that would help us reasonably to clear away obstacles that we hear against the church, Catholic Church?
Well, 2,000 years, the church has even now maintains unity against all natural obstacles, such as divisions and scandals and schisms and heresies and dissent. It's almost a miracle in itself that the church is still here, because a lot of that comes, schismatics and heresies and dissent comes from within the church itself.
Yeah, so attacks both within, schisms and divisions and heretics, and without the Roman Empire that tried to destroy it, as an example. Okay, what else?
Well, she remained stable over 2,000 years in the face of almost every form of external attack. But the first one was more the internal kind of thing, but also you mentioned the Roman Empire, but we could add many, many, many. Others.
Communism
was, of course, one of the
greatest. Really out to destroy the church.
And she has been able to propagate herself from the first under the most difficult of conditions. Her doctrine has always remained sublime, her sacraments symbolic of the grace they confer, her authority conducive to the salvation of souls, and her character unsurpassingly holy.
So again, we're willing and need to clarify that if we would follow what the Church teaches us, well, all of us would be holy. And the Vatican Council again said we have a universal or our all call to holiness, whatever our state of life.
I think of St. Francis of Assisi when he was he went to North Africa one time, he went before, somehow got before the Sultan.
Saladin, wasn't it?
Saladin, I believe it was. And he was trying to convert him, and he said, I think it was St. Francis.
I think it was.
And he says, Francis, if all of the Christians were like you, I would become a Christian.
Yeah, well, there's that whole thing. The best argument for the Church is a good, holy person.
Well, that's how you started this half-hour
right.
session.
Okay, what are some other ideas that would lead us and push us towards the reasonableness of believing that Jesus set up the Catholic Church?
Well, the Church has marvelously been fruitful in all manner of good works, projects, purposes, and people since her foundation. For example, her fruitfulness in charity, such as hospitals and orphanages and hospices and schools and aid to the poor and many other such types
all through history.
Things. All through history, yes. The antiquity of the Church. No other, at least Christian institution in the world's history, except comes close to its longevity. And I'm talking about an institution. I'm talking about something that's visible, mm-hmm. something that has organizational structure, that was created by Christ himself and continues right on down to this.
That anybody can find as right. a visible, organized unit.
Yes. The fact that the teachings of the Church have never changed over 2,000 years, that's a miracle in itself right there. The longevity of the Church in spite of its sinful members, including some bad popes and bishops.
Some people have said the greatest proof of the Catholic Church it has survived for 2,000 years with bad popes, bad bishops, bad priests, and bad Catholics. And when you think about that, there's no other explanation that I can see that except the hand of the Lord, I will be with you all days, even to the end of the world.
Well, the Church's phenomenal growth throughout the world, the holding power of its members, the unity of its faith and worship for 2,000 years, the sanctity of millions of its members over the centuries.
If I could just throw in there about this holiness of its members, on October the 15th this year, I'll have an opportunity to go with many other people from the area of the canonization of Mother Theodore Guerin, who is the founder of St. Mary's of the Woods in 1840. Okay, you got about a minute.
Well, I have
or so.
To mention this one, the countless miracles that are attributed to the intercession of the Church, just literally millions of them over the centuries. The Church has withstood the assaults of godless totalitarian forces such as Nazism and communism, as no other institution has done. And these are all motives of credibility that make it reasonable to believe what God, who can neither deceive nor be deceived, is revealed with divine faith. And we could examine every one of these claims in some detail. In fact, I teach a class at John Paul Catholic High where we actually, really kind of look at each one of these things in some detail as it's traced down through the last 2,000 years.
I think one of the great advantages of Catholic education today is apologetics is coming back strong to help the members as well as to be able to defend and explain the faith. Well, our time has run out again, so to all of you, may God bless you always and in all ways.